2016 marks Between the Lines' 25th year on the air. As we celebrate our all-volunteer independent media project's anniversary, please consider subscribing to our podcasts and supporting our work. Visit our website at btlonline.org, that's btlonline.org, for details on how to subscribe and make a contribution.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carl Tokay, staff attorney with the ACLU, who talks about his group's lawsuit against the U.S. Bureau of Prisons for refusing to release documents related to the agency's approval of a CIA torture site in Afghanistan. Arabelle Schoenberg, a member of the student climate change group Fossil Free Yale, who addresses a rally about Yale University's recent announcement that the school would divest $10 million from its fossil fuel holdings. And Sonali Kolhatkar, host of KPFK Radio's Rising Up with Sonali program, who discusses the emergence of France's Up All Night movement, where students and workers have launched protests challenging the economic status quo. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For the second time in a week, Macedonian police fired tear gas at a crowd of migrants in a resettlement camp in Idomeni, Greece. Since the European Union and Turkey signed a migration agreement on March 20th, over 50,000 migrants have been stranded in Greece, awaiting their asylum applications to be processed, while Greece's neighbors have shut their borders to migrants. To prevent further border clashes, the Greek army staged surprise military exercises along the border with Macedonia. Over 300 people were hurt during the first major clash with migrants along the Macedonian border on April 10th, after Macedonian border guards refused to open a gate to let migrants through. After the border incident, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras condemned the use of force. A Greek spokesman blasted the Macedonians' indiscriminate use of chemicals, rubber bullets, and stun grenades against vulnerable populations. After a second confrontation, Greek authorities arrested 14 European activists for encouraging immigrants to rush the fence. In the midst of the violence, Greece's far-right anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim party, Golden Dawn, has mobilized in cities where migrants have gathered. The Guardian newspaper reports that Chicago Police Department internal documents reveal that officers used physical force against 14 men in custody at a secret interrogation center known as Holman Square. According to the documents, police used punches, knee and elbow strikes, slaps, wrist twists, baton blows, and tasers against detainees at Holman Square, and The Guardian has identified two deaths of suspects that occurred there. The injured men were among over 7,300 people, more than 6,000 of them African Americans, who police documents show were detained and interrogated at Holman Square without public notice of their whereabouts or access to an attorney. The Chicago Police Department is now under federal investigation for suppressing a video recording of the October 2014 police shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. According to a report released April 13th by a task force appointed by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, department data gives validity to the widely held belief the police have no regard for the sanctity of life when it comes to people of color. The task force looked at more than 400 shootings in Chicago from 2008 to 2015 and found that about three-quarters of the people wounded or killed in police shootings were African American, though blacks make up only a third of the city's diverse population. Hispanics accounted for 14%, while whites made up only 8% of those shot. Since 2004, the city of Chicago has paid out over $600,000 in settlements for police abuse. High-profile incidents of domestic terrorism in places like Charleston, South Carolina, and Colorado Springs, Colorado, point to the rise of extremist and white separatist groups across the United States. In 2015, the Southern Poverty Law Center identified a 14% increase in the number of hate groups, even as activity declined among neo-Nazis and racist skinheads. Chapters of the Ku Klux Klan saw a big surge with the high-profile debate triggered by the movement to take down the Confederate battle flag from the grounds of the South Carolina Capitol and across the South. Rallies in support of the Confederate flag were held in 26 mostly Southern states. At the same time, so-called patriot groups expanded, espousing anti-government views and conspiracy theories. Mark Potok, a senior fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center, told the Christian Science Monitor, "There's a lot of anger among the white working class and to some extent the middle class." But, he adds, "In a society that's grown increasingly diverse, we as citizens need to work at building bridges. We've got a tough road ahead," says Potok, "but I don't have much doubt that after this long, very dark tunnel, we as a country will come out in a better place." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Since the public first learned about the Bush administration's approval of torture techniques used by the CIA and military personnel against suspected terrorists held by the U.S. at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba and other covert sites around the world, there have been a number of unsuccessful attempts to hold government officials accountable for their violation of international and U.S. law. On April 14th, the ACLU filed a lawsuit against the Federal Bureau of Prisons for their refusal to turn over requested documents under the Freedom of Information Act. The document sought by the Civil Liberties Group relates to a 2002 visit by Bureau of Prisons officials to a CIA secret detention site in Afghanistan, codenamed Cobalt, also known as the Salt Pit, where the Bureau's staff reportedly gave a positive assessment of the conditions there and offered training to the site's administrators. This despite documented evidence in the Senate Intelligence Committee's torture report that detainees held at this site were subjected to torture, solitary confinement, and sensory deprivation conditions, which led to at least one known death of a prisoner held there. Your reporter spoke with Carl Tokay, staff attorney with the ACLU's National Prison Project, who talks about why his group launched the lawsuit against the U.S. Bureau of Prisons and the larger issue of U.S. personnel and their superiors not being held accountable for their violation of international treaties and U.S. laws that prohibit the torture of prisoners.
So the first revelations about the Bureau of Prisons being involved in the CIA torture sites came out when the executive summary of the Senate torture report was released in December 2014. And we went through and realized, wait a minute, what is the Federal Bureau of Prisons doing at a CIA torture site? This is an agency that is responsible for running the federal prison system. They provide technical assistance to state prison officials around the country. And it was surprising to see them involved in visiting these black sites run by the CIA. What was especially surprising, though, was that the report indicated that they went to a particular torture site in Afghanistan that's codenamed Cobalt in the report. Many people know it as the Salt Pit. And they looked at the conditions there, where people were locked up indefinitely in solitary confinement, in total darkness, shackled to the wall with only a bucket to use as a toilet, and said, "We think this is not inhumane," and gave it a thumbs up and allowed the CIA to continue doing what it was doing. And that's profoundly disturbing for a number of reasons. So we filed a Freedom of Information Act request for all of the documents regarding the Bureau's visit to the CIA black site and all of the advice that they gave to the CIA afterwards. And they stonewalled us. They said, "We have no responsive documents." We did an administrative appeal where they responded the same way, and that's why we're now filing this lawsuit.
Carl, from the Senate torture report, what else do we know about this particular detention center that the CIA was running? I know that the torture report cited some instances where detainees lost their lives or were severely injured in the abuse of prisoners there by U.S. personnel. What do we know about this particular site, as you said, codenamed Cobalt or the Salt Pit?
Actually, on the very day that the Bureau of Prisons sent its inspection team to the Salt Pit, a detainee named Gul Rahman died. One of the interrogators had ordered that he be stripped of all of his clothing except for a sweatshirt. So he was mostly naked on the floor of his cell, chained to the wall in darkness, in temperatures cold enough that overnight he died of suspected hypothermia. And if you can just imagine the setting, some CIA officials called this place a dungeon. Another CIA official said that the baseline conditions of confinement were so extreme that it self-operated as a quote-unquote enhanced interrogation technique.
Carl, maybe you can discuss for us the larger issues of accountability here for torture undertaken by U.S. personnel in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks under the Bush administration. We know that higher-ups in the White House approved these torture techniques. They called it, by a euphemism, enhanced interrogation, I think was the term they used. How does this case figure in, from your point of view, with the utter lack of accountability for military and political leaders during those years when torture was officially sanctioned by the White House?
Well, it's part of the larger pattern of impunity for the officials who approved torture by the CIA. But I think another aspect of this is it shows how the culture of torture crossed over back and forth between the domestic prison system and all of these torture sites abroad. One of the things that many people don't realize is that, for example, Charles Grainger, who was the ringleader of the Abu Ghraib scandal in Iraq, worked as a prison guard in Pennsylvania before he was in the Army Reserves. The prison where he worked was filled with accusations that guards there engaged in brutal abuse, beating prisoners, spitting in their food, using racial epithets, and in one case, beating a prisoner and using his blood to write the letters KKK. That is the environment that Grainger came out of and then brought to Iraq. So all of this is connected. The toleration of abuse and torture in domestic prisons helps normalize it in all of the torture that the CIA engaged in abroad. The accountability is lacking, and it's something that remains important to address now in the future. At some point, we need to reckon with this history of torture, because otherwise, there is no way to stop it in the future.
That was Carl Tokay, staff attorney with the ACLU's National Prison Project. Learn more about the ACLU's lawsuit in efforts to hold government officials accountable for the torture of U.S.-held prisoners by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The second week of April saw a major escalation of climate activists on college campuses across the U.S., demanding their universities divest from fossil fuel holdings. At Yale University, a push for divestment coincided with a global colloquium of university presidents, which featured an address by United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, speaking on the issue of preserving cultural heritage. The April 12th speech was attended by 30 university presidents from all over the world, including several from the U.S. An hour before the event, Yale announced that it had divested $10 million in coal and tar sands investments out of its $25.6 billion endowment. Yale's chief investment officer, David Svensson, said the rationale for the change was in part due to a determination that such investments are unlikely to be profitable if carbon pricing is ever implemented in the future. Carbon pricing is designed to reflect the true destructive cost to the climate and the environment of burning fossil fuels. Svensson said Yale's endowment portfolio now includes only minor investments in coal and oil. Immediately following the UN Secretary's keynote address, where he briefly spoke about his support for Yale climate activists' call for all universities to fully divest from fossil fuels. 120 students and community members attended a rally organized by the group Fossil Free Yale and the Association of Native Americans at Yale. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the rally and recorded first-year student and Fossil Free Yale activist Arabelle Schoenberg as she spoke to those gathered about Yale's divestment announcement.
It's been kind of a whirlwind day for all of us. We're outside right now at the Global Colloquium of University Presidents. So presidents from Yale, Brown, Columbia, Princeton, NYU, and Penn are hosting Ban Ki-moon, the United Nations Secretary General, for the keynote address for this colloquium. So they're inside Sprague Hall right now. They are uniting under the theme of, quote-unquote, preserving cultural heritage, challenges, and strategies. So Fossil Free heard about this, and we were like, man, that sounds very hypocritical. How can these presidents claim to value cultural diversity and cultural legacy without even engaging in a conversation concerning the literal destruction of communities and victims of the extractive fossil fuel industry? So Ban Ki-moon just delivered the keynote address, and we had a bunch of members of Fossil Free Yale inside the room with him. So he spoke on climate change. He spoke on climate justice. So Ban Ki-moon has spoken directly against the power of the influence of fossil fuel companies and the harm they inflict on predominantly low-income, indigenous, and communities of color. He has urged companies to, quote, reduce their investments in coal and in a fossil fuel-based economy, and he believes that saving our planet, lifting people out of poverty, and advancing economic growth, these are one and the same fight. So Fossil Free Yale really believes that it is important to note that climate change is much more than just an environmental issue. It's also deeply, deeply human and personal. So earlier this afternoon, in preparation for this event, we received news 1 hour prior to the beginning of our action that Yale has decided to remove $10 million of our endowment from a few fossil fuel companies. So this is a huge victory, right? Yale has used this, unfortunately, not as a chance to expose the social harm or stigmatize these powerful companies, but as an economic tactic, saying that it makes financial sense because in the future, coal and oil will no longer be economically profitable. Yale has framed this choice as a confirmation of Salovey's sustainability initiatives, rather than acknowledging the work of groups like Fossil Free Yale and ANE, who intend to frame divestment as a tactic for the stigmatization of the companies that harm so many people. Given the lack of information we have been given, it seems apparent that Yale has made a deliberate attempt to kind of mess with this action today, and we don't really think this timing is coincidental. But it is also important to recognize that Yale has heard us, and Yale's scared. So it was hard for me at first when we got this information to realize and to begin to understand that the university really is acting secretly. The university is acting behind closed doors and kind of intending to mess with and like sabotage the work of these student groups who have been working so hard to create this event. But all of that aside, it's also really important to recognize this recent change as a huge victory for divestment, especially at Yale. Regardless of intent, Yale's corporation members are starting to talk about climate change and to change their behavior. This victory is small, and there's still a lot of work to do, and it's really important that we do continue to keep fighting for what we believe in, and that we don't rest until we start to see concrete change here at Yale and also around the world. So this victory comes at a really meaningful time in conjunction with other divestment campaigns across the country. So today, students at UMass Amherst are, like, currently at this second, engaged in a sit-in. So they have 100 people who are sitting in, and we've had word of a potential 50 arrests of students at UMass Amherst. And then we also have had word from Harvard, where 4 people have already been arrested for their action as well. So basically, we just want to talk about this in the context of the greater divestment movement across the country. And really, like, universities and people in power are really starting to see us. And not only are they starting to hear us, but they're also starting to listen. And Yale's statement today demonstrates that they're starting to respond to student activists on campus. And this partial victory is an important first step, although it does not reflect an ethics-based university-wide commitment to divestment. Hopefully it represents a change in the consciousness of these universities and really a step towards what we've been fighting for all along. So thank you guys all for coming.
That was climate activist Arabelle Schoenberg of the student group Fossil Free Yale. Find more information on the movement calling for the divestment of fossil fuels at U.S. colleges and universities by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The nation of France has a rich tradition of activism, where in the name of social solidarity, many citizens feel obligated to take a stand on social justice issues, from opposition to war to human rights and labor strikes. It was in that tradition that thousands of students, trade unionists, and progressive activists launched spirited protests across France on March 31st in opposition to socialist president François Hollande's proposal to weaken the country's protective labor laws that unions assert favor business at the expense of workers. But the protests have transformed into a new movement across France and beyond, known as Nuit Debout, or Up All Night. Each evening since March 31st, activists have gathered at Paris's Place de la République to debate and protest against a diverse list of grievances, from immigrant rights to economic inequality and youth unemployment, which now stands at 24%. Although there have been clashes with police and some violence, the movement appears to continue to gather momentum and has now spread to Belgium, Germany, and Spain. Up All Night, which has attracted thousands of supporters, has been compared by many to the U.S. Occupy Wall Street movement, the Indignados uprising in Spain, and even Paris's own student worker protests and strikes, which paralyzed France in May 1968. Your reporter spoke with author and columnist Sonali Kahatkar, host and creator of KPFK Radio's Rising Up with Sonali program in Los Angeles. Here she discusses France's Up All Night movement and its challenge to the nation's economic status quo.
Well, I went to France for the first time last December for the COP21 protests, and France is an amazing country. People are very politically active. They're very politically aware. It's a society conscious, particularly of their labor rights. You know, people have worked very hard over the years to preserve strong labor rights. It's routine in Paris for the entire city to shut down and go on a general strike because, you know, there's some union that's upset about some attack on it. So basically what's happened is that the French president, socialist president François Hollande, you would imagine that as a socialist president, he would be more friendly to workers' rights, but he's been basically unrolling a neoliberal agenda in France and little by little chipping away at the rights of workers. And so he just unveiled labor reform that he has proposed that would essentially make it easier for employers to fire workers. It's very difficult in France to fire somebody, whether you're in a union or not, and most people are. And he basically said that, you know, this would make it easier to hire people. So it would actually be really good for the economy and for workers, but workers weren't buying it. People were very upset. And what happened was on March 31st, a number of people gathered in the Place de la République, which is a very symbolic place in Paris. It has a national monument. It became a site of mourning of the victims of the Charlie Hebdo attacks last January and the victims of the November 13th terrorist attacks. So people gathered there to watch a film called Merci Patron, which essentially means thanks, boss. And it's a film about ordinary French people being threatened by a corporation and being screwed over by a corporation. And apparently what happened on the night of March 31st was that film riled people up so much. They were so angry about the proposed labor reforms. And the film kind of inspired them to do more. And they decided to stay in the Place de la République all night. And thus was born the so-called Nuit Debout, or Up All Night, or Rise Up at Night movement. So people stayed in the Place de la République. It got bigger and bigger. More people came. They stayed overnight. They had Occupy Wall Street-style General Assembly meetings and continue to have them. And they basically decided, we're going to draw the line here in the sand against these reforms. But also, this is sort of a broader, you know, kind of just say no to austerity programs, to pro-corporate, anti-worker programs. And they have been there since March 31st.
Sonali, what is the unifying cry here in terms of the organizing going on in France and across borders in Europe? Is it anti-austerity or is it something larger than just fighting back against policies in France and these other countries that are asking more from workers in terms of givebacks and such?
You know, my understanding is that essentially this is about strengthening democracy. People are angry that, you know, things that are popular, policies that are popular, are not being pushed by the government. People are angry that their elected representatives continue to kowtow to corporate forces. Of course, here in the United States, we're very familiar. This is a longstanding tradition in our political landscape. But in France, it's becoming worse and worse, and they're not as used to it as we are, and they're understandably and justifiably very angry. And so the broader aspect of this is strengthening democracy. The narrow issue is the opposition to the proposed labor reforms, but by and large now this is becoming a sort of pro-democracy movement. How do we strengthen democracy? How do we revive our democracy? How do we wrench it away from corporate control and back into the hands of ordinary people? And so people are having discussions. Now, of course, the downside of these large spontaneous mass uprisings or gatherings is that they are often leaderless. And often they may be a little inarticulate because, of course, the nature of these gatherings is that no single voice rises above all else. There's a lot of back and forthing, a lot of group discussions, mass group discussions. And so you can take one impression away from it, which is what the mass media usually does, which is that these groups don't know what they want. You know, we heard this criticism of Occupy Wall Street. They didn't have clear demands. And that's true of Nuit Debout as well in Paris. But the upside of that is that people are getting this feeling, just like Americans did during Occupy Wall Street, that they have the power to take back democracy, that if they physically occupy a space, it makes them feel empowered and gives them the confidence to demand even more. Interestingly enough, the former finance minister of Greece, Yanis Varoufakis, recently visited the Nuit Debout, the heart of the Nuit Debout protests in Paris. In France, the epicenter is the Place de la République, and he was the anti-austerity hero of Greece last year. And when he was finance minister with the Syriza party, the left-leaning anti-austerity party, he's just written a new book. And he, you know, he felt it was important enough to go to Paris and be at this gathering because he also understands that this, in a way, is an affirmation of democracy and a rejection of austerity and essentially pro-corporate policies.
That was author and columnist Sonali Kalhatkar, host and creator of KPFK Radio's Rising Up with Sonali program. Find a link to Sonali's recent TruthDig.com article titled 2 weeks into a major uprising, French activists still staying up all night, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.